Now you know why we have a warm-up speaker, that because her presentation gives me plenty of things to talk about. While you were sharing, Colette, I started thinking about similarities and differences. And, you know, I love AA, and I love the differences in AA, because they're entertaining. All the different people you meet in the meetings, their stories are different, and it's so much fun to sit there and look at the differences that people in the meetings talk about, and you can say, well, I'm not like that, or I'm kind of like that. You know, but it's the similarities that keep us sober, and that's what I've learned over time. It's listening to somebody else in a meeting. It's listening to Colette talk about, you know, how she deals with life and sobriety and saying, God, I have the same problems, you know, and that's what keeps me sober. You know, if you're new, I think what I want to get across, if anything, tonight is that AA is a safe place. That's what it's been for me. It's a safe place where your similarities will be emphasized and your differences will be respected. And if I have any admonition or anything else to say to, you know, the many, many people in this audience who have more sobriety than I do, it's that AA should be a safe place where the similarities are emphasized and the differences are respected. I know that we've all been threatened with rolling intermittent blackouts in the last 24 hours, but you know, I didn't have to do that yesterday. And probably nobody else in this room had to do that yesterday. And at least at one point in my life, that was unthinkable. You talked about, Colette, you know, that you had all this evidence that you were going to be alcoholic. I didn't have that. My story isn't like that. In fact, there was little, if any, evidence in my background or when I was growing up that would suggest I would be alcoholic one day. You know, at least in brief, I came from what would be called a good family. It's a wonderful family, and it's a wonderful family to this day. They never stopped supporting me, even when I was having the most problems that I could ever have. And growing up, I did everything I was supposed to do. I did everything I was supposed to do. And I pretty much blame a lot of my drinking on the Cleaver, you know, family. One of my claims to fame, one of my few claims to fame, is that I actually went to college at Berkeley with the Beef. You know, he lived next door. And I remember looking at this guy, you know, with his puka shells and his sandals and his real long hair, and, you know, it was fashionable at the time. And he still had that moon face. You know, he still had the freckles, and he was just, you know, he was the Beef. And I was thinking on the way over here that, you know, that's what my childhood was like. That's what my background was like. I mean, my dad was like Ward Cleaver, you know. And I was the oldest. I guess I would have been more like Wally, you know. We did all the wonderful things that families are supposed to do. My parents didn't drink. My grandparents didn't drink. My grandfather on the mother's side was a deacon of the Baptist Church. He would know more. One of the famous family stories is he once found some apricot-flavored brandy my grandmother had hidden in a cupboard to use in cooking just to flavor things. And he found it, you know, work of the devil, boom, boom, $40 worth of apricot brandy down the drain. You know, that was my background. And I grew up doing everything I was supposed to do. I was a good little boy. You know, I remember the most trouble I ever got into in elementary school was I kicked a volleyball. Whoa. I mean, I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember that, but that's a real bad thing, kicking a volleyball. You know, that's pretty bad. And I came along and I came into adolescence. Oh, God, I remember going to a dance. I remember going to a dance, and Martha Paul Hemus was going to be there. You know? And my mother dressed me in the Beaver's clothes. I mean, these slacks that were like, you know, crisscross, what do they call it, crisscrossing pattern slacks, polyester, blue and black, you know, and white, and this kind of shiny sweater, you know, and I went to the dance, and Martha had nothing, I mean, she was listening to Jimi Hendrix, okay, and I looked like the Beeve, and I'm like going, oh, I don't fit in. I do not belong here. all those other guys are so cool, and I don't belong here. I remember that. And about another year went by, and oh, God, here it comes. Sadie Hawkins. Sadie Hawkins. And I don't remember the gal's name now, but I remember there was this good-looking gal. And she came up to me about 3 weeks before Sadie Hawkins, and she said, "Do you want to go to Sadie Hawkins?" I just about went, "Yeah, I do." You know, because she was good for the eighth grade. She was good. About a day later, I found out she wanted me to go with her cousin, Mary Nell. Ooh, that was not good. That was not good. You know, because it mattered. My whole reputation, my standing in my eighth grade community depended upon whom asked me to go to Sadie Hawkins. And Mary Nell was not a good date. She was not a good date. And so we went through all the build-up, you know, we got the same clothes, and we were supposed to go to Sadie Hawkins. And I remember there was this guy living down the street, and this had never, ever, ever occurred to me. But we were supposed to go to a baseball game before Sadie Hawkins, you know. And I said, "Let's have a drink." I'm about 13, eighth grade, whatever age I was. I said, "Let's have a drink." And he went, yeah. So we snuck into my parents were the kind of people that had, you know, like bottles of booze that had dust all over the top of them because they would never get them out. They would never touch them. I mean, you know. And so we got, all I knew about drinking at that point in time was you were supposed to drink hard liquor and you were supposed to mix it with something. And so we got gin and warm tab. And we drank a fifth of gin between the two of us. And that's the last I remember about Sadie Hawkins. That's the last I remember about Sadie Hawkins. And I had an intermittent rolling blackout that night. And, I don't want to make this a drunkalogue, so I'll just be, you know, really brief and just continue with the theme by saying that, you know, I recovered from that absolutely horrendous, embarrassing event. And continued on doing what I was supposed to do. I got the education I was supposed to get. I got the degrees I was supposed to get. In my family, I knew that the only thing that was ever permitted to me is I could be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, or a librarian. That was pretty much it. And I went ahead and I did what I was supposed to do because Tom, expected it. And I learned something very, very important as a child, and that is it's very important to be different. It's very important to be distinct. It's very important to be preeminent, and it's very important to follow the rules. That's what I learned as a child. And the reward for doing all those things, if you do them successfully, is you obtain love. You are loved. You are loved because of your degrees. You are loved because you honor your parents. You're loved because you do good things for your community and good things for your family. And so love is not something that's given. Love is something that is earned. Love is something that's earned. It took me a long, long time to figure out that my family would have loved me no matter what, because they are good people, very good people. And they would have loved me no matter what, but I knew I had to earn it. And the only way I knew how to earn it was by working very, very, very hard and controlling everything around me. I had to control my circumstances. I had to control myself. I drank fairly lightly through most of the time I was going to school, and I had this very prolonged adolescence. You know, you go through high school and then college and then professional school and some graduate school and you do some, you know, and by the time you know, you're 30 years old before you become an adult. And during all those years, I did a fair amount of drinking, but not consistently. And in retrospect, really not abusively. But what I remember about that drinking is I always had to control it. I always had to control how much I drank. And I'm not really sure I even knew that at the time, but to me now I remember that I always had to stop when I didn't want to. And most times I did stop. Because I had things to do, and I had this love to earn, and I had these degrees to get, and I had this profession to build, and all that stuff. So I controlled it. I clamped down on it, and I didn't abuse alcohol. When I graduated from law school and went into my profession, that was a heyday for me. I'll tell you, you have money in your pocket, you really don't have too many family responsibilities, and you're in a profession where they encourage you to drink. They tell you to drink. It's how you entertain clients. It's how you lubricate the deal making. It's how you relax at the end of the day. It's especially how you relax on Friday afternoon. And as the years went by, it just became more and more and more consistent. Okay? I wasn't blacking out. I wasn't barfing. I wasn't getting tickets. I wasn't having any problems. But I began to drink every day in a pattern. And that's part of my story, is that I drank absolutely, rigorously, obsessively. Okay? I drank, in the end, at the same place, at the same table, at the same time of day, the same drink, seeing the same people, over and over and over again, every day. And people started to complain. Most prominently, my wife began to complain. And I had this wonderful excuse for drinking, because I had a laptop computer. You know, laptops had just come along. And I could take my computer to the bar after I was tired of working at the office all day, and I could sit there and work and drink at the same time. That may sound crazy to you, but I did wonderful work while I was sitting there getting sloshed, because I could write my letters and write my memos, and, you know, God, the clients would call up and they'd say, "You're wonderful, guy, you send us more letters than we need," you know, because the, yeah. I'm sitting there working 3, 4, 5 hours a night, you know, getting drunk as a skunk, but I could still write. I could still write my letters, and I could still do my work. And how could anybody complain about my drinking? Because 5 hours a night, you know, without talking about rates, I mean, that's not a small amount of money. 5 hours a night's pretty good billing. You get a lot of money for doing that, you know? How can you complain? I'm working for you. I'm working for the family. Bob, we think you might be an alcoholic. Ooh, that was the best one of all. Lawyer came out and said, "You know something? You're right. I can't help it." I acknowledged I was an alcoholic long before I came to AA. Why? Because it got people off my back. "You're an alcoholic, Bob. You drink too much." "Yeah, you're right. That's it. Now leave me alone. I got to go do it. I got to work. I got to, you know, blah, 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 blah." And, you know, I learned to use an admission of alcoholism to get the heat off. You know? Maybe that's a difference. I haven't heard that in a lot of these rooms, but that's the way I did it. You know? What I did not admit was that my life was becoming unmanageable. What I did not admit was that even if I wasn't having accidents, and even if I wasn't barfing, and even if I wasn't embarrassing myself at parties, at least not most of the time, I'd begin to be depressed. And I'd begin to work because I didn't know anything else to do. And I'd continue to try to achieve because I had to earn love and respect that I knew inside I didn't deserve. Why? Because inside, I knew I was a fraud. I knew I wasn't as smart as people thought I was. I knew I was different than other people. I mean, I felt this in my soul. I knew that if they found out the truth about me, that they weren't going to like me. And I knew that if they found out the truth about me, worse than that, they wouldn't love me. And I knew that if they found out the truth about me, they'd take my law degree away and, you know, take it all back. Because I was a fraud, and I knew inside I was a fraud. Does that make sense? Is it incomprehensible? Yeah, it is. But that's the way it felt. And booze took that away. It took it away. It was wonderful. I found out that when I drank, I didn't feel different. And I found out that when I drank, hell, I could even concentrate better than I could when I wasn't drinking. And I found out that when I drank, I didn't give so much of a damn as to whether people loved me or not, or respected me or not. And I mean, I know a lot of you have heard this before. Drinking wasn't my problem. I drank very well. You know, life was my problem. Life was my problem. So I could admit that I was an alcoholic, but I could not admit that my life was becoming unmanageable. And what happened for me towards the end of my drinking was that life became this ugly, black, grinding pit of despair every day. And the incomprehensible demoralization came in because I could not figure out for the life of me how to break that cycle. Because the only thing I knew that I was any good at was working hard. The only thing I knew that I was good at was generating money so that other people could have a good time. The only thing I knew I was any good at was taking care of other people's problems, because that's what I'm paid to do. I have to take responsibility for and take care of other people's problems. And you know what? It's a wonderful profession, because when you're doing that, you don't have to think about your own. You don't have to deal with your own demons. You don't have to deal with your own depression. You don't have to deal with your own obsession if you're taking care of someone else's problems. So I began to live a life that, instead of being multidimensional, just had a single dimension. It was just work, drink, listen to the wife bitch, and then go back again and do it the next day. That's it. That's all I did, and I did it for years. And the emotional part of me would break down sometimes. God, I tell this story on myself because for me it's incomprehensible demoralization. I went across and I tried a case in Inyo County, which is across the mountains. And I was there for 3 weeks. And if you've ever been in Inyo County, you know there isn't much there. And I was staying all by myself in this little rundown hotel. And I didn't drink during trial, didn't touch a drop during the trial. It was a big case. It was very important for my career. It was for a major client. And it went really well. I won. It was tremendous. And the whole time I was there, I missed my family so much. I missed my wife and I missed my kid so much. I couldn't stand it. I called them every night and I'd say, I cannot wait till this trial is over, until I can get home. And you know what? I went out and made my closing argument, and I was outside for about 10 minutes. The jury called us back in, and I won. And I mean, it was slam dunk. It was wonderful. I went through the ceiling. It was so cool. And there's nowhere to celebrate in Inyo County. So I packed up all my stuff. And I drove, and I told my wife, I won, I'm coming home. As soon as I got to Fresno, just won at Livingston's because I deserve it. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening. Just won at Livingston's because I've been working so hard, and I deserve it as a reward. Needless to say, at 1:30 in the morning, my wife was not pleased to see me. Now that was incomprehensible demoralization, because why was I at that bar? There may have been multiple reasons, but one of the reasons I was there was to get love and respect and affection. I had this family waiting at home who would have given me all those things, and yet I couldn't seem to make it that 2 more miles to get home. And I look back on that today, and I really do not understand why. To this day, I don't know why I couldn't make it home. All I know is I didn't. Okay? When the book talks about a sign of alcoholism being the first drink gets you, and you keep on going, and you drink when it doesn't make any sense, and you drink even when you don't want to, that I understand. That I understand. But still in all, that's just being alcoholic, and I admitted I was alcoholic. That's it. I mean, that's no problem. My life became unmanageable when I came down to breakfast one morning, and my wife said, by the way, we're moving to Pennsylvania this afternoon, and you're not invited. Moment of clarity, I don't know what it is. All I knew was I hated everything about myself that morning. It helped that I had a hangover, because I was always depressed when I had, you know, hangovers. And I didn't want to drink. I mean, especially not in the morning when I was depressed. And my wife was leaving me. And my kid was leaving me. And they were going 3,000 miles away. And I didn't blame them, and I didn't think they were wrong. I knew they were right. For better or for worse, that's what got me into sobriety. I called a friend because I didn't know what else to do, and that friend said to me, Bob, you need help. And I said, yes. I didn't fight it at all. I just said, yes, you're right. And 24 hours later, they found me a recovery home. So I went to the recovery home. I remember that first night being in recovery going, who are these la-la people? I mean, they're all happy now. You're in the right place? I don't think so. You know, I mean, this is real nice being here in Monterey Bay and all, you know, and the house is real nice and the food's okay and that. But I don't know any of you people, and you don't drink, and you're going to make me sleep tonight with an 18-year-old crack addict from San Joaquin Valley who keeps screaming in the middle of the night how he's going to go home and take business because his girlfriend got dissed. Okay. And it's costing me $5,000 to do this, by the way. I don't know what happened. All I know is I woke up the next morning and it was okay to be there. And the only thing I can think of is that I was so goddamn fucking tired from the drinking and the endless work and obsession and pattern and over and over. I was so emotionally and physically tired that I was just happy I didn't have to go to work that day. All I had to do was get up, put my sweatpants on, an old t-shirt on, and go and sit at the stupid meeting while these people were talking to me. And the first thing they told me was, lawyers will never get you. You'll never make it. This old fart told me you'll never make it because lawyers can never give up control. Control? What are you talking about? I had no idea. No idea at all what he was talking about. None. I do not know how I managed to grow up with all this education and all this exposure and all this knowledge, and I had no clue at all as to the basic principles of this program. Because after all, AA is not unique. There are other programs that use these principles. But I had never been exposed to anything like that. So when the guy said, you can't give up control, so you won't be able to get... I had no idea what he was talking about. And when I got back to Fresno, one of the very first things I heard in the meeting was, your own best thinking got you here. And I went, oh, shit. Oh, God. Now I'm really stuck. I'm really stuck. Because you know what? The only thing I had going for me after all this time was the degrees and my abilities and my intelligence and my da-da-da-da-da-da. And damn it, when somebody said that, I knew they were right. I could not deny that. That with all my own efforts, all that intelligence, all the advantages, all the things that had been given to me, which were very, very considerable, my own best efforts had gotten me sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, at Fresno Fellowship back when it was over by DeChico, going, okay, I'll do this, but I, you know, I don't know what's happening. But I was sober. I'd been sober for 30 days. And at that point, I knew I wanted my wife to come home, you know. And I knew if I could just stay sober long enough, maybe she'd come home. And maybe I wouldn't be bankrupt at the end of a divorce. That never did happen, by the way. I did get my son back, but she never came back. But I was confronted with the reality that my own best thinking, of which I was so proud, and of which I was so enormously confident, had gotten me right where I was, sitting in a room of AA, being forced to confront that I could not manage my own life. You tell that to a Norwegian-Swedish boy and his family, the Cleavers, that you can't control your own life? That you can't control yourself? That you do things that you were unable to stop? That's worse than death. That's worse than sin. Loss of control is the ultimate failing as a human being. That's what I knew before I got into this program. The other consequence of my drinking that became apparent to me very early in sobriety was that I had absolutely no clue whatsoever what I liked about life. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know what I wanted to do. All I knew was what you were supposed to do. All I knew was how you were supposed to act. I didn't know what I liked. I sat there for the first time in many years by myself in this stupid big old house with the dog and the cat, and that was it. And I had some time on my hands because I decided I was going to give myself a break early in sobriety and not work so hard. And I had no idea what to do with myself. I didn't know. I mean, that was really a conundrum. How could I stay sober if all I ever did was sit around in this stupid house thinking about how to stay sober? I knew that much about myself. I knew that if I said, I'll never drink again, that wouldn't work. Because I had previously said, I'll never smoke again. So I knew that was going to be a problem. And I'd learned a little bit about one day at a time, and that helped. And I knew about staying sober through fear. I'd learned that much in recovery. I knew about staying sober because of the consequences of what would happen if you didn't stay sober. Okay? I knew about preventing myself from drinking because she won't come home, or I will lose money, or I'll have to go to that stupid recovery place again. And so I'd kind of figured out early on about staying sober through the fear of being drunk. But not too far into sobriety, I began to figure out that that probably wasn't going to work for me in the long run. Because I have a tremendous fear of lung cancer, and that hasn't stopped me from smoking. I mean, I really do not want to die of lung cancer. But so far, that hasn't worked. So far, that hasn't worked. So affirmative sobriety, whatever you want to call it, I had to figure out how I could live comfortably in sobriety and have a reason to stay sober. And my answers came very slowly and haltingly and were sort of experimental. Working with a sponsor early on, someone I'm very grateful to, one of the smartest things they ever said to me was, go ahead and be obsessive. Just don't obsess on drinking. So I did. I watched every stupid goddamn Schwarzenegger movie that had ever been made because you know what? It had always been too low class for me to watch. By God, I won't be able to, you know, you can't drink Chardonnay and watch Schwarzenegger. It does not work. And I read it, every single one of them. You know? Milkshakes. Sugar. Ugh. I don't want to be fat. I want to be out of shape. But you know what? Booze has a lot of sugar. It has a lot of sugar in it. And early in sobriety, I replaced the sugar with milkshakes. Chocolate milkshakes, 3 times a day, endlessly, watching stupid action movies that, you know, Was that obsessive? Was that a reasonable way to live?
Yeah.
Probably not, but I didn't drink. I didn't drink. Sex. It's a good obsession. It'll take your mind off drinking. Video games. Computer games. That'll take your mind off drinking. Are these wonderfully constructive ways to live your life in accordance with the holy dictates? No, probably not, but they help me not to drink. And that's my experience. I don't recommend it to anybody else, but it did work for me early on. Service was very important to me. I think this is just personal, but given my background and what I did and the values I was raised with, service was something that I could do unequivocally and know it was a good thing. Because there was something that happened to me in sobriety that gave me a reason to stay sober aside from fear. And that is, not that I was made sane, but that I was restored to sanity. And I think the word restored to sanity is important. Okay? I remember very early on in sobriety having this overwhelming sense that I had become myself again. And that was the first of the great gifts for me in this program, was that I realized that for many years, I'd been living like a machine. I'd been living this bizarre, incomprehensible, grinding black, ugly life. And I didn't feel good about it, and I didn't feel good about me, and I didn't feel good about the people around me. And in sobriety, something happened. I became Beaver again. I became Bob again. But with a difference. It was a choice. I became Bob because I wanted to be Bob. Not because my parents would love me, not because my wife would come home, not because my kid even would love me, because by that time I'd been told, you cannot stay sober for something else or for someone else. You have to be sober for yourself. And I wish I had better words to describe what that felt like. But I just remember about 4 or 5 or 6 months in there, somewhere in sobriety, having this overwhelming, profound sense that I was me again. And that it was okay. And I think service had something to do with that, because I guess it was Palm and Shaw. Someone said, you got to chair a meeting, and all I'd learned that far in sobriety was that you don't say no to an AA request. So I said, fine, what am I supposed to do? Well, I found out it just means you show up early and make coffee, which is really bullshit. But, you know, it's service of a small kind. And I did something else, and this was on my own, and I'm not saying anybody should or should have to do this, but I was very grateful for what I'd gotten at Beacon House. Mostly I'd just gotten a good rest and some good food, and they got me over the initial shock of some things that I'd been dealing with. But I was very grateful to the people there. And so I volunteered to go there once a month and just kind of be available as a lawyer to help, you know, whoever was there at that time if they had any legal problems. And that was a wonderful experience, because once a month it got me out of town, it broke my routine, and it allowed me to deal with newcomers, you know, even at a point where I was only about a six-month newcomer. And that was wonderful, and I felt good about me. For the first time in a long, long, long time. And the more I felt good about me, the less I felt bad about losing things. Because I was like Colette. I lost the house. I mean, the divorce went through and it was a disaster. Because, among other things, I didn't have any trouble admitting that it was my fault. And so I said, here, you take it. I'll take the debts, you take the stuff. You know, well, now we know why lawyers shouldn't be their own clients. Or, yeah. Woo! They say a doctor who has himself for a patient is a fool. Okay, well, same thing for lawyers. But you know, I survived that. I continue to survive it. And will continue to survive it. I'd grown up, oh man, I wanted that house on Van. I wanted the house on Christmas Tree Lane. I wanted the house on Christmas Tree Lane. And I got it. I got it. And when I lost that son of a bitch, oh, it was hard. This is 2 or 3 years into sobriety. And I lost the big house. And I'd held on to it much too long, much longer. And I held on to it out of ego. You know? So it's not like you walk in here and you learn everything right away, guys. It takes a while. And a while. And a while. You know? Serenity prayer. That's what got my ass through. I mean, I even got down to the point where I said, I have number 1 days, you know, serenity. Number 2 days where I need courage. Number 3 days where I need wisdom. You know, and I could categorize all my days by, is this a day I need serenity? Is this a day I need courage? Or is this a day I need wisdom? And it helped. It helped. Because I got to flip into something briefly. Similarities and differences. And I want to be very gentle about, you know, how I share this. This is part of my story, and I have to share it. I think that the Woodward Park Village Group kind of keeps me around as the pet agnostic, because they find it's amusing. To say the very least, higher power has been something of a difficulty for me. And I want to say this affirmatively and not negatively, because I have the most profound respect for people that I deal with in AA who are religious. And I have an even more profound respect for the positive impact of religion on people in AA. But it is not something that has worked for me. And if there is anyone out there who wonders if this program can work without conventional religious belief, I think that it can. I think that it can. The best I've been able to come up with in this area is to think about those part of the steps that say God as we understand him. Okay? I hear a lot of people say that the as we understand him part is permission to make up your own God, and I don't think that's correct. I think as we understand him is a reference written by this guy in the 1930s, or a group of people in the 1930s, who were going back to an older, you know, Christian tradition that said, God is perfect, men are imperfect, and how can the imperfect understand the perfect? Okay? So I think as we understand him simply means we're not very bright when it comes to God. Okay? I stopped fighting this battle, and it's an important part of my story, because there was a time when I felt disqualified from sobriety. I felt that I was not allowed to be an AA. I felt, again, different than. I felt different than. And this time I didn't have anything to help me. Okay? And there are, I wish Uncle Bill was here tonight. Uncle Bill is a good example of, you know, somebody who just disagrees with me totally. Couldn't disagree with me more. But he's accepting of me, and he's my friend, and he talks to me, and we love each other. On this issue, we just disagree. Stuart, we just disagree. But I know Stuart loves me. And I know Stuart respects me, and I know Stuart would help me. I'm profoundly grateful for that. But I want to tell people out there, if you're having trouble with higher power, just keep trying. I've come to believe that it's the struggle to find a higher power which may be more important than finding one. And the resolution for me, when I stopped fighting the higher power issue, is when I just stopped to say to myself, okay, I don't know God very well. Whatever it is, I don't get it. I don't get it. I used to be so angry about God. Furious when people would mention, and I still have that tendency. I still have that tendency. But what helps me today is to remember what I learned very early in sobriety. My own best thinking got me here. And I don't know everything. And maybe it's okay if I just say, I don't get it. I don't get it. Maybe I will someday. But please, one of the messages I would like to send out is if anybody here is struggling with that, really struggling, look for your higher power, but don't insist that it take any particular shape. And don't let anybody else tell you that it must take a particular shape. I'm not here to tell you the truth, but neither is anybody else. It's the seeking after a higher power. It's the seeking after integrity. It's the seeking to be oneself that's worked for me. Because I've been restored to sanity. For better or for worse, I tend to think of it as something as simple as I try to do the right thing. Now, I don't know whether that's ordained by God, whether it's something I make up, or whether it's coming from somewhere else. But I pretty much know that there are right things and there are wrong things. I pretty much know that deliberately swerving out of my path to run over cats is not a good idea. Now, do I believe that because God told me don't do that? No, I don't, personally, I don't. But I know it's wrong to do it. Okay? I mean, it's not even because I don't want to pick up the mess. That would be logical. I know it's not a good thing to kill for no good reason. I know it's not a good thing to push people away when I might be able to do them some benefit. I know that it's not a good thing to sit in a meeting and watch a newcomer walk out the door because they feel alienated. And that does happen in AA. That does happen. And that's the tragedy. So, AA is a safe place where similarities are emphasized and differences are accepted. What's it like now? I wish I had a better answer. The only answer I have is balance. Am I going over time? No? Okay. Okay. I wish I had a better answer for life and sobriety than this one, but it's balance. Okay? Having heard a little bit of my story, I think that the analogy makes sense. What I thought of as my life before I got sober was I was like a big bad wolf, huffing and puffing, you know, at this house, and I was blowing up this balloon, and it got as tight as it could, and it was huge, and it was egotistical, and it was taut, and it was so rigid and so perfect, and all it took was one little prick, and it was gone. And it just... And when I went into sobriety, I was so exhausted, so collapsed, so empty, so limp, so nothing. My balloon was as empty as it could be. And sobriety for me has been a process of slowly reinflating the balloon with pins on the outside and pins on the inside. Okay? Where if I try to blow it up too fast, I'm going to pop it. But if I blow it up too slow, it's going to pop too. Okay? Because I want to be restored to sanity. All right? So in my profession, I don't want to do it for the money anymore, and I particularly don't want to do it for the money so I can send it to Pennsylvania. Okay? I have to, but that's not the reason I want to work. I mean, it may sound silly, but this is maybe the one group where I could actually say this. I want to work for justice. Now, does that mean I'm going to throw away my lucrative career and I'm going to suddenly go and work do poverty law? No. No. But I can effectuate justice within my own sphere. Okay? I want to find a good reason for doing what I do. I've gotten remarried in sobriety. I am much more sensitive now than I ever was before to my failings as a husband, but I would like to be a good one. I have been reunited with my son. I am much more sensitive now to my failings as a parent, but I would like to be a good one. Okay. Balance is not a very satisfactory answer for anybody, I don't think, because it's not clean. You know, you can't grab on to the concept of balance and say, if I'm balanced today, everything will be great. Because what is balance? You don't always know. It's kind of like riding the horse, you know? I mean, I guess you know it until you fall off. When you're unbalanced or imbalanced, it's fairly apparent. And so what I found that during sobriety, I kind of lurch from problem to problem and just try to get better as time goes on. Now, who helps me with that? Meetings. Meetings. That's what helps. Okay? Because, and again, I truly am not making fun and I don't disrespect anybody, but, you know, getting on my knees and praying in the morning, don't do it for me. Okay? That's just my personal thing. What does work for me is making myself show up to meetings and dealing honestly with the people that I know and who know me well enough to know when I'm full of crap. Okay? I go to meetings because it's a commitment to myself. I don't go there to impress anybody. I don't go there to get anybody off my back. I don't go there to be of service to newcomers. If that works, I hope it does. But I go there so that I can live a life of balance, so that I can talk to people, be honest to people. Why? Because it's safe there. Where else can you go in this world where it's safe? I mean, I walk into a courtroom, I guarantee you, that ain't safe. You know? Or I walk into the job where I deal with partners and bosses, that ain't safe. You go home, that's not always safe. Dealing with kids, that's not... This AA is the only place safe to be weird, to be different. It's the only place where you feel better when you walk out later. Maybe not coming up a little bit short on time. But brevity is the soul of profundity. Thank you.